Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see ya. How sweet to be here with you. Looking out the window, there's like a lot of leaves. How many? 4,373. And they're fluttering, each one uniquely. And I'm just thinking about how everyone in this room is fluttering uniquely. So the vast diversity of experience, even my experience from when I started this sentence to now, is actually pretty great. And then the people in this room, some of you may be feeling very spacious and calm, and some anxious or angry or excited. Yeah. And that's just in this room. And right now, give us 5 minutes after I start talking, you never know what's going to happen. So this is where we live, in these moments. And I hope we can just continue to practice to open our hearts to all of it, to everyone, to everything that we are that arises within ourselves. It's like you can look out the window and be like, wow, look at all those leaves. You don't really need to count all 4,372 of them. Just look. So I'm going to talk about the Gandavyuha today. Everyone will all say, Ben, talk more about the Gandavyuha. Let's get all these. I actually can't remember what Gandavyuha directly translates to, but the title that Clary gives to his translation is Entry into the Realm of Reality. So this is an invitation to meet reality as it actually is, which in the view of the Gandavyuha is much more awesome and amazing and wondrous than we usually notice. All right, I need a bullhorn because it's raining. The Gandavyuha is the last chapter of the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is also known as the Flower Garland Sutra, or the Flower Ornament Scripture, or the Huayan Scripture. And I would just say, like, Huayan Avatamsaka teachings, they emphasize to an enormous degree interdependence. And in particular, they take all the implications of interdependence and point out how awesome, wondrous, beautiful, and joyous they are. They point out how they invite us to be deeply attuned to and in celebration of our sensual experience moment to moment. And they point to the vast diversity of the kinds of experiences that people have, the kinds of cultures we create, the kinds of tendencies we have, and the kinds of different capacities for liberation that each one of us manifests. So this is the vibe that the text is bringing. So the basic story of the Gandavyuha is that there's a boy named Sudana who feels a sense that he really wants to be there for the liberation of all beings. He wants everyone to be free from suffering, and he really feels it. And so he essentially goes on a pilgrimage. He meets 53 different teachers. Every one of them says something like really mind-boggling, transmits to him an amazing teaching, which he internalizes. And then they say, by the way, I don't really understand awakening. You should go talk to this next person. And then he talks to someone else. And every time it's amazing, and every time they're like, I don't really know. They're really going to know. So one of the things, there's a lot to play with in this text. So just for today, I'm going to focus for a little bit on the tendency of Sudana to encounter a teacher and to have that teacher be surrounded by people who are similar to them. And I'm going to read some passages here from the text. So Sudana has met a bunch of teachers. He's traveled unbelievable miles. And someone has said, you should go find Bhishma Motara near Gosha. So Sudarna saw the seer Bhishma Motara Nirgosha wearing matted hair, sitting on a seat of bark, rags, fragrant grass, and antelope skin, on a layer of straw, in a hut built at the foot of a sandalwood tree, surrounded by 10,000 other seers. He finds the seer. The seer is sitting humbly with a lot of other seers. Amazing things happen. You can imagine those. Fill in the blank. Liberation. So then, a little bit later, he's met some other teachers. Someone says, you need to go see the girl, Maitriani. So he gets to the town where she is, and he's trying to find out where she is. And people say, the girl Maitriani, with a retinue of 500 girls, is up on the roof of a palace of radiant jewels, sitting on a seat on sandalwood legs and draped with nets of strings of jewels and arrayed with celestial cloth, expounding spiritual teaching. She doesn't even get antelope skin. He gets a suggestion later on, after a few other visits, to visit a young boy named Indriyeshvara. Sudarna, surrounded by celestial beings, spirits, and cherubim, made his way to the city of Samukha in the land of Shramana Mandala, looking for the boy Indriyeshvara. Then, when Sudarna got to the city, Samukha, near a river junction, he saw Indriyeshvara surrounded by 10,000 boys playing in the sand. He went up to Indriyeshvara, paid his respects, and said, noble one, I have set my mind on supreme perfect enlightenment, but I do not know how an awakening being is to learn and carry on the practice of awakening beings. That's, he says that to everyone, by the way. Kind of is like, hi, how you doing? Okay. I'm just going to keep reading. Later, he's invited to meet Prabhuta. Prabhuta is an almost goddess-like woman, and he talks to her for a while. She gives a whole bunch of teachings that's really mind-boggling, and he's like, wow. And her teaching is, I feed people, and that enables them to awaken from suffering. So a lot of the teachings that people provide are like, I give people food, I give people medicine, I help people find shelter. Also, I help people transcend space and time. You know, just the usual stuff. So he's talked to Prabhuta for a while, and she says, do you see these 10,000 women, my companions? Beginning with these, there are countless tens of thousands of hundreds of thousands of women whose practice is the same as mine, who are one in vows, one in the roots of goodness, one in the ways of emancipation, one in purity of devotion, equal in purity of mindfulness, equal in infinity of understanding, equal in attainment of spiritual faculties, equal in pervasive awareness. Goes on for another page or two. But anyway, they're pretty awesome. And they're all over the place. Wow. So then, he meets a nun. Someone says, go meet this nun. He says, okay. Goes to meet the nun, and he meets her, but there's actually many of her. So it's just her, but she's all over the place, and she's surrounded by different gods. Okay, I'm not going to read that, but it's pretty neat. alleviating the pains of all sentient beings. That's what she's doing. I'll read one more section. So then someone's like, oh, you need to go see this earth goddess. And he meets this earth goddess, and she's surrounded by a whole bunch of other earth goddesses. And those earth goddesses, led by Stavara, the main earth goddess he was invited to visit, caused the earth to tremble, made the ocean roar, illumined the whole universe with a glorious light, and with bodies adorned with all kinds of jewelry, like bundles of lightning bolts descended from the sky, emerged from the surface of the earth, with all the tree sprouts growing, all flowering trees blooming, all rivers flowing, all lakes and ponds rising, fragrant rain showering, great winds bearing flowers. And it goes on for another paragraph or two. Emerging from the earth. Wow. A lot of different kinds of people that Sudana encounters. But interesting, in so many of these cases, they are surrounded by like. Surrounded by like. So I, you know, was thinking about this, as one does, just walking down the street thinking about the Gandavyuha. And I was like, well, I never noticed that. There's so many times, it's like 500 of the same. And I just had this flash. This was kind of the first impulse for this talk, this particular talk. Was, I had this flash of when I was in early recovery from addiction. And every time I saw someone like take one drink, I was like, that is so impossible, bizarre, and you are totally unlike me, and I will never understand you. A person who can take one drink was seen by me as utterly foreign. I don't understand how that can happen or what you could be like to be able to do that. Because for me, the occasions on which I have taken one drink is probably zero. When I was 12 years old, the first time I drank till I blacked out. And I did that thousands of times. And so in the process of learning how to be a person who just didn't take one, it was really necessary for me to spend a lot of time with only people like that. I withdrew from almost all my friends. I based my life about finding a supportive community so I could be safe and make the transformation I needed to make. And I had to have this ridiculous mental construction that everyone who was in that boat was just out there, like incomprehensible. And, you know, I think developmentally that was fine. It was just like, I just got to find my space here. So I had, like, surrounded by like. And it was pretty good, you know. It's been a long time. I haven't had a drink in, I don't know. I really should know. 26 years, something like that. So then I thought, wow, I found it interesting getting it with like, find like. So this other story popped up in my mind, and I was on a board of directors several years ago for an organization that was not MZMC. Some of the women who were members of the board said, you know, the men on this board, there are men on this board who are manifesting really harmful patriarchal tendencies. And it's afflictive for us and it's harming the organization. Like, whoa. So I solicited input from the women on the board about what those patriarchal tendencies were, what they saw that was happening that was afflictive. And we convened all the men who were on the board and we sat down and we talked about how to not do that stuff. How to not do that stuff. Like, getting together with like. We made a little affinity group of men. I hope it was helpful. And we got good feedback, so that was good. So, you know, we have affinity groups here at MZMC, like specific affinity groups. So we have a LGBTQ plus Dharma group. And that's really fun. You should just become queer just so you can hang out with us. Like, we have a good time. I'm bisexual. I'm the facilitator. It's really great. And it's really needed. You see, one, it's just like there's some special vibe that happens there that can't happen elsewhere. And there are people, you know, who come in and it's... you can see it's really meaningful. It's meaningful to me. And we have a people of color Dharma group, and we have recovery Dharma group, and we have waking up to race, which is for white folks dismantling, who want to work on dismantling racism. So you can see how that's kind of similar to that board work, where you took a group of men And in the United States, it's really necessary to have white groups. You know, it's not like I don't need a white affinity group because the whole culture is designed to accrue power. And if you look around this room, you can see that this is a predominantly white group. So one of the things with affinity that we see in the Gandhiviyuha is like people just getting together with who they like, who they're used to. A problem in the US though, is that because so many institutions of power have been predominantly white and male for so long, that it's really worth taking the time to dismantle those tendencies so that something else can happen. And what we'll see is that although in the Gandhiviyuha there are these affinity groups, there's also a lot of taking them apart as well. So both are honored. The fact that people tend to just convene like with like, the value of that, and the value of moving through that. So Sudana is on this pilgrimage. So every time you encounter one of these groups with like a woman surrounded by 500 women, or a girl surrounded by 500 girls, or a boy with 10,000 boys playing in the sand. That's my kind of Dharma teacher. Every time that happens, Sudana is meeting them. He goes there to meet them, and he just basically says, I'm here to learn from you. And then whoever it is just gives this teaching, and Sudana is like, thank you so much. And then the person's like, sorry, I really think you need to talk to someone else too. And he says, okay. Total receptivity, total openness to moving between the groups with their tendencies. Because he's trying to shed everything that blocks the possibility of everyone being free from suffering everywhere forever. Just a small aspiration. So we see various versions of this like not with like, many of them, but I'll just read a couple. A quick one, there's a mariner, so a sailor. And I was like, oh yeah, the sailor is surrounded by sailors, but actually, then I realized that's not true. Let's see. So he, like the 40th teacher, he sees his Vaira, the mariner. Sudana made his way to Kutagara city looking for the mariner Vaira. When he got there, he saw the mariner surrounded by hundreds of thousands of merchants and hundreds of thousands of other people to wish to hear and talk, explaining to them the oceans of virtues of Buddhas by talking about the ocean. Oh, you want to teach the Dharma by talking about trees? Because you know about trees, you want to talk the Dharma by talking about poetry, because you know about poetry, you want to talk the Dharma talking about cooking, oceans, waters, ants, hearts, minds, teeth, there's no limit. So anyway, but notice he's surrounded by other kinds of people. It's not a bunch of sailors, it's merchants and just other people. Then there's Asha, who is a healer. He finds the laywoman Asha. Those who came to her affected with various sicknesses, filled with various afflictions, immersed in various views, covered by obstructions caused by karma, had their sicknesses alleviated when they saw Asha. He wasn't even explaining it. Embodied transmission. It's a basic to the Zen methodology, embodied transmission. You just come in the room, we do the stuff together, something happens. Something happens. So, this connecting across what appears to be other difference is also a theme in the text. You know, Sudan is often hearing kind of about situations he's completely unfamiliar with, right? He's not sick. He's not, the mariner's talking about getting lost at sea. He hasn't had that experience with. So no, Because that's part of understanding how we can all be free. So, you know, MZMC has a little steering group, which is Jay, Ted, and I, called Racial Justice Action. We're inviting you to attend Healing Minnesota Stories Dakota Sites Tour. I think it's October 26th. So Healing Minnesota Stories has been around for about 5 or 10 years. It started with Bob Clanderoo, but some other Indigenous people have been doing it now. It's Jim Baird Jacobs and Kelly Sherman Conway. And they take groups of people to sites that are significant to the Dakota people in the Twin Cities, and they talk about that space from their perspective. And then the people who are attending can listen. And I haven't been to one yet, but many, many people I know have been to them and say it's a really powerful and valuable experience. So I just encourage you to jump on in. You'll see the emails and stuff. Probably my favorite story in the Gondavuha is the part about playing in the sand. No, maybe right now. That sounds pretty fun. But I think rather than trying to read this, I'm going to paraphrase. So Sudana encounters one person. It's like a goddess. And she says, I'm going to tell you a story. By the way, at the end of the story, she says, by the way, that was me in a previous life. But she says, tell you this story, which is about a prince. And the prince lived in a kingdom where his father had a lot of people who were condemned to die. And the prince just realized this was wrong. And he said, you need to not do this. And his father got really mad. And then the prince said, okay, well, I'm willing to die so this doesn't keep happening. So I'm just going to give my all. And so he advocating, and all the king's advisors are like, you need to get rid of this guy. He's a usurper. So they're planning to kill the prince. And the prince's mother intervenes, the queen, and she's like, give him like a month to just try out what he's doing. And the king's like, all right. The advisor to kill the prince. Mom says, don't kill the prince. The prince says, here's the plan. We're going to release all the prisoners for a month, and we're going to give them all the food and resources they need. And everyone awakens. That's the story. You might think, well, that's kind of a rapid time frame, I understand. But this is not a new idea. So one of the only texts that refers to incarceration or that kind of thing in the Pali Canon says the same thing. King says, what should I do with these criminals? Should I lock them up? And the advisor says, no, you should just give them all the resources they need. You should give everyone the resources they need. And that's what they do. The sutra ends with the line, and the children will play in the streets. This, by the way, is the basic principle of what in modern times is called prison abolition or police abolition. So, I don't know. You know, the U.S. has the largest prison population in the world per capita and in numbers. Per capita. Wow. It's like, take in the idea that instead of using violence, you could use generosity. Even if you're like not going to get really into prison abolition, is there some place in your life where instead of violence, you can use generosity? Instead of control, giving. Probably. So throughout this text, we have this, you know, the Avatamsaka is all about relationality, relationship. And so here we see, oh, you can have relationships where you're with a lot of people you are similar to, with people you're totally different from, you can connect. All different permutations are laid out there. And it's interesting to just practice, you know, one of the most basic senses between that's underlies this whole dynamic is the idea, which is not a true thing, that there's a self and an other. Seems like it probably, it seems to me like there's a self here and there's another thing. So I'd just like to play briefly with the self and other deal. You know, the way I want to do this is by chanting together. So what I want to do is do a chant. And what I want to do is the Bodhisattva vows, which if you don't know them, are on the bottom of your program. And the idea here will be to chant this one. Hey, Melinda, would you do me a favor and close both the that door and the sliding doors? Thank you very much. We don't need to chant. I'm often like, chant, rah, rah. You know, I'm really into getting people to do that. Oh, I got people meditating in there. So now we can practice chanting. So, chanting these vows a few times. So the first time we chant through, I'm going to invite you to just not really worry about anything, but just trying to chant with everyone and have it go okay. For some of us, that's plenty. So we'll go through once and just kind of, we're just chanting together. This is what's happening. The second time, I'm going to invite you to really focus on your voice. Try and just see that your awareness is a very, or the focus quality of your awareness is a very malleable phenomenon. And so you're just going to be like, okay, now we're going from whatever the focus was to really just focusing on my voice. And then we'll go through a third time and really focus on the other voices. And then the fourth time, both. Balance. Self. Okay, and I'll like call these out kind of like Pete Seeger would. You know, right before you have to do the thing, I'll be like, we row the boat! Or Holly Near. So, yeah. If you don't know the chant, you may want to hold it up here. So first, just chanting. Don't go. Second time, your own voice. All the way through, all the way through the four vowels. Third time, other. Fourth, self and other together.
Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it.
Now other voices.
Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it.
Harmonized.
Beings are numberless, vowing to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. become it.
Thank you. Let's feel that right in here. I was surprised. I didn't really have a prediction. I noticed when we all were listening, the volume dropped. People were like, oh, I got to change my voice so I can hear. That's interesting. Yeah. You know, the Gandavyuha is so relational and outward looking. The Avatamsaka is, in a sense, it's a response to the enormous focus in some early Buddhist texts on the interior experience, which is, there's a lot of relationality in early Buddhist texts as well, but there is some sense of response. But seeing the balance between caring for what's here and caring for all of it, and then realizing that these don't have to feel so conflicted, they can start to feel more flowing and integrated with practice. So, Sudana, his vibe, like, one thing is, like, it's all with Sudana. You never lose sight of the fact that it's like this person is meeting these people. It doesn't disappear. And yet, like, there's always a sense of opening, and actually, like, he's learning and he's meeting people, and it's a sense of expansion and freedom. Oddly, he seems totally incredibly expanded and free from the very first page. And then by the end, when at the sort of climax of the text where he enters this tower and really gets to the top of the tower and realizes the whole world is towers with sudhanas in them. I'm everywhere. I'm not separate from anything. But the funny thing is, actually, like, if you really look at it, you're like, he's already totally awake from the beginning to the end. And what that awakeness looks like is this relentless meeting and opening and expanding. This is actually a theme. It's like one of the most famous lines of the Avatamsaka Sutra. What's a good translation? The mind's first aspiration for awakening is true awakening. Mind's first task. I'm translating a text with my partner Wei Jen Tang that's related to this, and I was like, the heart's first aspiration for awakening is true awakening. He said, that's not what the text says. The mind's, all right, Wei Jen, you know Chinese and I don't. anyway, I'm really grateful for his support. What's this about? Don't wait. Don't wait to wake up. You're already awake. What do you think? You're asleep? Does it seem like you're asleep? I don't think so. This is awakeness. It's not somewhere else. And yet, we can be like, oh, what that awakeness means is waking up. Again. Now. What's this? I hope everyone in this online meeting can hear those leaves shimmering in the breeze. Seems unlikely. What's shimmering in your breeze where you are? I see someone with a house plant. You should put a fan on that. Oh, she's okay. She's miming it. We're good. So, yeah. And you know, MZMC can, like, it's got some Gandavyuha vibes, and that's like, I want to keep waking up into that, where it's like, you know, there's an affinity. People who come here usually are into Zen, most of them. I think every once in a while are people who are into classic college and have to come here, but that's okay. You're into Zen now. So there's room. We have affinity groups, particular affinity groups. We have people with affinity for gardening, they gravitate toward that. People who have an affinity for being in the kitchen. It's like everyone's out there for tea and there's like five people that just gotta be in the kitchen. Ah, that's cool. So we can find those people that we're like, find that connection, but we can also work to open the door, open the door? Who's not here? What do we have to do to make this a place where everyone can find affinity here? There's work to do. And how can we be like, oh, this whole thing where the need for affinity can soften for many of us. You know, I don't have to view people who can drink one drink as utterly foreign. I'm just like, you're just people. You just have some habits that are a little different than mine. That's cool. So there can be this ability to be boundaried in a way that's healthy and safe and be boundless, and also be boundary and move porously through whatever the boundaries we've established are. You know, one of the ways where I'm getting, I'm just like kind of excited about doing this sort of thing is through just celebrating all different kinds of practice here. So, you know, we've got this thing here we do called Zazen. It's cool. Yeah, it's really great. And it's the core of our practice. And we have walking meditation and services that we do 5 days a week. So they're the Dharma talks, which are really like, there's a lot of that going on here, but there's so much else that happens here. So, you know, there are people who care for the gardens, people who care for the kitchen. Few people came over here and cleaned for an hour yesterday. Thank you very much. I'm not even going to listen to that because what I want to talk about is just the new offering we have. New offering at MCMC. So we're trying something new called the Day of Practice. So we're going to have a couple of non-meditation intensive retreats this year. But every retreat that I know of that we've had since I've been here has been a lot of meditation, you know, maybe 6, 8, 10 hours in a day. We do workshops sometimes, which are very much like there's a teacher and they're sort of teaching constantly and there's breakouts and all that. The Day of Practice is more like an opportunity to be immersed in the kind of life that a temple or a monastic life has when you're not in formal periods where there's tons of meditation. So there'll be meditation, but there'll be opportunities for work practice. There may be opportunities for art practice. There'll be teaching. There'll be time for just relaxing. What's more relaxing than work practice? I don't know. But anyway, the truth is the exact format of what's going to be included in these is a little bit TBD. But check it out. Check it out. Especially if you've been like, oh, I want to do a retreat, but you people are nuts and it's really hard. And in part, what this is about is like listening to people saying that. Why do we have a place where people want to do a retreat? Can't do it if that's too hard on their body. I don't want to do that. I want to listen to people. Yeah. So, and those of us who are doing the more intensive meditation retreats can aspire to have our practice be as good as the people who are not. Yeah, there's no need to compare. There's space for each person to find their own articulation of practice here. And when we practice Zazen, when we just sit in this core and central practice of the Soto Zen tradition, there's this sense, perhaps, that it's like I'm here, sitting. And I'm hearing things, seeing things. Perhaps I'm thinking things, maybe most of the time. Yeah, but really the spirit of investigating the relationship between the apparent self and the apparent other as a means to collapsing those distinctions so we can realize the whole and a vast liberation for everyone. It's in there. It's in there. I've just been reading Uchiyama Roshi, and he talks, he's using the term self, but basically he's talking about how in this moment, for any one of us, no other anything will ever experience exactly this. Like right now, whatever you're experiencing is absolutely and only yours, or at least particular. There's no other entry point in time or through any other consciousness. So there's this, I mean, the self here is not like myself looking at things, because this moment includes everything that's seen, heard, felt in the heart, thought, smelled, tasted, or touched with the body. But it is utterly unique and particular. Sudana is always Sudana. There's just this thing. And yet, if we sit and really open the senses and put down the discriminating mind through practice, that sense that there's a self looking at other things can soften. And over time, the sense that there's a moment that's separate from other things can soften. You don't actually, I don't know anyone who can actually see backward in time or perceive past moments immediately. I mean, you can remember, obviously, the future, but the solidity of the idea, it's just an idea and a tendency of consciousness that this moment is separate from the rest of the universe. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean it isn't real. And so that can soften because that separateness is just constructed by habits of mind. So as we sit, not denying the elements of the self, not denying or pushing away any of the phenomena, the tendency that turns it into a bunch of separate stuff can soften. And we don't destroy the separateness. Sudana doesn't die. He wakes up. We just also realize a vast connection, where the only natural response is compassion. All right, well, thank you all very much. Thank you all very much. Now is the time for other voices, questions of any kind, or reflections. And if you're online, you can either just unmute and talk, or you can use the raise hand thing. I'll go with Carrie first.
Hi, this is Carrie. Thank you so much for this talk and bringing a text that you really made more accessible through your talk. So I appreciate that. And I have been thinking about this, and you know, being the person who heads up the POC group, Dharma group there, you know, I like what you said about there, you know, there's a time for things and there's a need for things in our lives. And so the need for having these affinity groups is there, and people find that really helpful and beneficial to access the Dharma in that way. For me, it's a feeling of safety that I need through that affinity group to allow me to then participate in the larger groups. And so I really appreciate that you brought that up, and you had your own experience of that, and you related that to everybody. So thank you.
Thank you, Carrie.
So I wanted to share that, echoing what you said about having opportunities to do different ways of practice. My first one-day retreat was sort of like that. It was a contemporary retreat that Usho Lan had about 2 months ago, or maybe a little more. And it was very enriching because we did a lot of sitting, but we also had an opportunity to do work practice and to have lunch in our container and it's very cool that Carrie had a chance to talk, because I was actually going to say that thanks to Carrie, I found a way to not feel that cleaning was mandated by a gender role. Because I am gender fluid, I had struggled with that a lot. And once I did that one day retreat, or have that contemporary retreat, I, thanks to her and to the way that she organized it, I could find a way to practice that in a way that was mindful, that I didn't need to feel like in any way it felt in an opposition to who I am. And now I can practice it at home, and it feels like I'm extending my Buddhism into cleaning my spaces.
Thank you. Thank you. I think I wish I was better at bringing my cleaning practice to my home. So maybe you can give me some teachings after the talk. I'm okay. Others. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I'm very glad to be here and listen to you speak.
Thank you.
I really appreciated the text and you bringing to attention noticing your senses, like fluttering of the leaves. That's something I notice all the time. And it's kind of the magic in the world that we overlook often, because we're in our heads and we're, you know, walking down the street to get to an appointment. But to slow down and really connect to your senses is a gift, because you really notice all the, what I call magic, which is kind of just the light of the senses, the calmness that can bring. And by doing that, you feel the interconnectedness, not in an intellectual way, but in your whole being.
Mm-hmm.
As a visual artist, that is something that is a gift, is that perception, and it brings me a lot of joy and peace.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you. Yeah,
I have a question.
I just noticed some people are having a little trouble hearing, so make sure you use your
Phone. I'll pretend. I was just wondering, if you were to give like one book recommendation on this subject specifically, maybe in addition to the book that you just read.
But I'm actually not recommending it's a tough read without some support, teaching support.
Yeah. Introductory.
Jeez, I don't know. Nothing is really coming to mind, but maybe I'll think of something after tea. When book recommendations often for me are very personal.
Okay.
Sometimes there's like, oh, there's the perfect entry for this, but I'm writing it. There really isn't. I'm trying to write a book to help that happen, because I don't know.
Oh,
and that's why I'm writing it. Anyway, so I'll try and think of something. Thank you. Go ahead.
You talked about Christmas here. And that mentions that crime in a society is the sickness of the society and not the criminal. So I think that's something to keep in mind.
Yeah. Crime in the society is of the society and not the individual. But we also have individual responsibility. So both those are true, I think. But one view seems to be heavily emphasized in our culture. Overly emphasized. Anyway, Raul.
Good morning. Hello, Ben. Thank you for the talk. Just a couple things that I can definitely relate with, and you're mentioning of, you know, having to be surrounded by the like and the mental reconstruction. And I can't remember the last time that I just had one drink. I know that it's happened before, but very few and far between. And I'm just very grateful that I don't have any drinks these days. And I'm just looking forward to being able to be there in person here starting next week. I've been unable to the last month and a half because I moved out of the cities temporarily, and the mental reconstruction, just myself being more steadfast in meditating daily, because I know that that helps quite a bit, even, you know, physiologically speaking, with the change cellularly, so to speak, with, I believe it's the left frontal cortex. Anyhow, I just wanted to say thank you. And if I'm correct, I may not be, but yeah, just glad to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Looking forward to seeing you when you get back to town. Other voices. Yeah, Katie.
So I was reading the quote on the front of the bulletin about asking, do you have any relatives? And the relatives are the mountains, the rivers, and the whole earth, the plants and the trees are all my relatives. And it reminded me of talking to a friend about how often in our culture, when we ask, do you have a family, they mean, do you have children? And how we really should expand our concept of family. Because everyone has a family of one sort or another. Even if it's not blood relations, there are people who are your support group, who are your family. And I just think that Zen is a great way to expand that concept of family and relatives and interconnectedness.
Thank you for that, Katie. Yeah, I forgot that I put that quote on the bulletin. But, you know, more precisely, yeah. You know, people who don't have kids, cool. There's millions of ways to make connections, and many people in the queer community really need to focus on chosen family because they're profoundly rejected by their birth families, and, you know, countless other conditions. So, yeah, what does family mean? I just want to recite the koan that's on the thing so the people online can hear it, and maybe I'll say something very brief about it, and then we'll wrap up here. A monk on pilgrimage met an old woman living alone in a hut. He asked, do you have any relatives? She said, yes. He said, where are they? He said, the mountains, the valleys, the plants, and the trees are all my relatives. So ultimately, the whole thing, Sudarna's practice of meeting particular things as a way of moving towards the whole thing. But that whole doesn't destroy the parts. The particularity of the little paths that nun walked down, the particularity of how your family is, chosen family, children family, biological step family. My family tree is a bush. So, yeah, and every leaf on there, I love them. So thank you all very much. Really sweet to be with you all. And I will turn it over to Ardilan.